person grows up, none of you are still 2 feet high and walking around with training pants on. And I hope none of you are still going to bed with your favorite teddy bear. Though I'll leave that somewhat open. What if you are? Huh? Advise you to watch MASH sometime. Huh? The lady, what was it? What's it? Radar, I guess it is, in his teddy bear. Very interesting study in human pathology. Huh? 8-foot bird story? Yes. Although all people are created equal, obviously you're going to see vast differences between the individuals. There are going to be difference in capacity, strength, and in particular, as we look at marriage, their capacity to understand each other. And that has to do with maturity. In general, then, I think we can conclude that a mutual commitment to each other forms the structure or the skeleton on which a marriage exists. And this skeletal structure of marriage is protective. It is supportive. It must be conducive to growth. And it must be conducive to change for both partners and for the children. If it's not, it will endeavor to keep the children as little bitty kids or stop their growth at some point. Or it will endeavor to maintain a denial of life and its principles with regard to the partners, such as growing old. I met a person once who didn't want to grow old, so he never planned very far ahead. He was making millions of dollars. He didn't even have a will. And his business was operated in such a way that he planned only a few months ahead of himself. And then he waited until the last minute to stay up all night. Bring in his staff and they'd work hours and hours and hours till the wee early morning. Yet he made money that way. I remember when he came to see me, he says, "My dentist says I have a problem. He says, I'm gnawing the surfaces off my teeth." And I says, "Oh, why do you think you're doing that?" He says, "Well, I'm doing it at night. I don't know why I'm doing it." I said, "What kind of schedule are you keeping in your day-to-day activity?" The schedule he was keeping in his day-to-day activity was such that he worked hard hours, always under pressure, trying to avoid death. You know, the marriage can't grow very far. You're always trying to avoid death. There's been a number of things done in recent times that seem to fall under areas called marriage enrichment. Everybody now has their little program for marriage enrichment. In fact, I'm doing a workshop tonight with 20 couples. Marriage enrichment. So, it's very popular. And I suppose someday in your church, you'll call somebody in or you'll do it yourself in something called marriage enrichment. Let me suggest to you, there's a very good material that's been coming out by a couple of writers by the name of David Mace and his wife, M-A-C-E. And there are others as well. These have been studies of normal functioning marriages. And what's interesting about the studies that have looked at normal marriages is that they confirm the same thing that I've been talking to you about studies of sick marriages. That the marriage must have a commitment. The marriage must have self-supporting and supporting of other type of people involved in the marriage dyad. If these two elements are not there, the marriage is going to have problems. And the structure, which is in the marriage, the commitment part of it, must be one which involves the elements which I just presented to you. Protection, support, conditions for growth, producing growth, conditions for change in both partners as well as in the children themselves. That is not always present in marriages, sorry to say. And in fact, I hope that you have seen as we've looked at it, is that some marriage actually sabotages it so it's not present. And you may ask, why do people do that to themselves? Well, I'd like to turn our attention to that at this point. I'd like to talk a little bit about the meaning of love in human relationships. Love seems to be a very central experience for humans. And I think we could go so far to say that love is a central, if not the central, experience in every human life in all cultures. By that, be that as it may, I think we still must say that there has yet been no satisfactory theory about what love is. Scripture probably comes closest to it, yet it presents a number of pictures of love, which I think suggests to it is that love is not one particular thing, but a combination of a number of aspects of human existence. Tell you what, you guys are writing very quickly to get them all down. I'm going to take each point at a time. So, all right. Yeah, thanks, after you got to six. Okay. There are four observations probably that can be made. First of all, one would assume that love makes people happy. Whenever I say that, I have to think back about a statement that I once read. A particular clinician who was quite famous, he said, everyone knows this, that love makes people happy, except the scientists. Sigmund Freud. The normal person, one would assume then, would be a person who can work and love. And you say, well, where does that come from? Well, it has some scriptural basis to it. Yeah. I haven't gotten to there yet. I'm still leading up to it, okay? Just a second, another paragraph. I've got three more points before I get to that. Normal person is one who can work in love. Interesting thing, once a newspaper writer decided that they would ask Sigmund Freud what the most important need was for a human being. And apparently the newspaper writer was ready with his tablet, ready to write down reams of paper from this brilliant clinician. And he turned around in about five words, I think it is in German, he made the statement, to love and to work. The second principle I think we need to make, or observation we need to look at, is that the peculiarities of a person's love life can be traced back to some of the dynamics coming out of their childhood experiences. How they learn to love. They learn by the experiences of being loved and of expressing love to other people in all of its various characteristics and styles of relating. The third principle, or observation, let's not call them principle, let's call them observation. Although love ideally makes people happy, the experiences of love, which you will tend to discover people who come to you for pastoral counseling with, are going to be experiences of love which are neurotic in nature. Simply put, neurotic love is immature love. If you assume that Scripture, in the akapao sense of the word love, teaches that which is most mature, you're probably correct. Jesus and the New Testament writers, as they teach about love, especially in the 350 times that akapao and agape are used in the New Testament, it is very definite teaching about that which love that is mature. And that is a different kind of love than neurotic love. But mature love isn't something that happens miraculously. It is something which grows. And I think that's important to see. Everybody and their brothers got some idea about love. Yeah. If I asked every one of you to write a definition of love, we would have as many different definitions of love in here as there are people, if you wrote a thorough definition of love. And some of them wouldn't have anything to do with each other. And there would be wide gaps in the definition, because that's the way things are. And we would have a free-for-all at some point in time disagreeing about which theory is most correct. There is an assumption which I make based upon observation of working with people in a clinical type of setting, is that during the course of pastoral care and counseling with an individual, there should be observed a progression from neurotic or immature love toward mature love. And if this progression succeeds, and I think we might say as it probably does in the majority of situations, then the individual knows more happiness than they've known previously. To say this, I'm using my definition that some of you remember, or I hope you remember, from back in the fall quarter and introduction to counseling, that the ministry of pastoral counseling is a ministry of sanctification, of maturing, of enabling the Holy Spirit to be released in an individual's life to express and move the person towards more maturity rather than childish type behaviors. Well, let's start at the point where you're going to see people rather than the point where you're going to see maturity. Because when a person comes to see you, they're not going to come as a mature person. There'll be no need to come see you for help. There are some clinical manifestations of love which are neurotic in character, and you will see them. There will in each of them be an initial and very brief period of euphoria. And each of these seven neurotic characteristics or neurotic forms of love will proceed from this brief initial euphoria into a considerable amount of unhappiness. If you were to sit down and read hundreds of volumes that have been produced on this subject from clinical literature by itself, probably would have to have your dictionary along with you. I do. And I've been looking at this stuff for a period of years now. If we were to summarize this, I think we'd come up with seven different areas or characteristics, and these are the seven. First of all, love as a rescue fantasy. Very intriguing. There are three essays which Sigmund Freud wrote back and published in 1910 called Contributions to the Psychology of Love. Very interesting subject. He wasn't proceeding to write a full theory of love. He just was contributing something to one's impression about it. And he suggested that there are some people who see love as a rescue fantasy. From observation, I think one would conclude that this is primarily found among men, yet not exclusively. It's also seen among women. And even more so today in the strong emphasis of liberation, woman's liberation. I think it's increasingly on the bound with a woman rescuing the poor male damsel in distress. Anyway, the man in this situation wishes to rescue the woman from her unhappy lot. Therefore, he is apt to pick a woman who's realistically unhappy. Wouldn't do much good to rescue somebody who's not unhappy if you're looking to rescue somebody. Sometimes, notice in the older clinical literature on the subject, that it dealt with primarily those persons who rescued social deviants. Some of the early writings back at the turn of the century in the first 20 years of this century deal with the woman being a prostitute who's been rescued. That is less the case in recent studies in the same area. What happens is that the women in these marriages are substitutes for the male's mother. See, in the family of this man, the mother is seen as an unhappy woman. And she has been made unhappy by the misery imposed upon her by the brutal father. And the male here sees that sex is forced upon her by a man who uses her as a spittoon. Such is her happy lot. No, I should say, such is her unhappy lot in this type of marriage. In reality, the woman comes into the marriage unhappy. And if any marital partner comes into the marriage from an unhappy situation, and looks for the marriage to suddenly make them happy, please be aware that they bring their unhappiness with them, and the euphoria is not going to destroy the unhappiness. The unhappiness is going to be back, and it's going to be worse. Because sooner or later, as the woman who has been rescued from her unhappy lot gets over the euphoria and starts being unhappy again, her husband, who has rescued her on his white horse, who now has mud up to its gauntlet, is quite upset by all of this. He can't keep his horse clean, and he's worried, and he begins to regret his sacrifices, of which he's made considerable ones in rescuing this woman that he wanted to rescue. And a rift results, and increasingly it widens with time, and especially after children are born. An obvious significance of the love of this kind, as well as what we're going to see in each of these six others, is that sexuality is assigned to a debased position. If in your love relationships that you see between marital partners, sexuality is debased, then the love pattern between the partners is neurotic. It's a one-to-one comparison. For instance, if love is clean but sex is dirty, that's what I mean by sex being debased. In this way, of the love is clean, sex is dirty type of idea, various forms of neurotic love all derive their unresolved, incestuous fixation in the Oedipal situation. Now, some of you who are taking personality theories from me know what I'm talking about when I say that. Others of you who haven't dealt with that, I probably need to define it. Unresolved, incestuous relationship is what goes on in the Oedipal and Electra complex of 3 to 6 years of age. A fixation means that the person's growth and development got stuck there. You do not have to except Freud's idea of a child wanting to have intercourse with a parent to see this activity going on. In fact, I would suggest that you don't have to accept that at all. But one thing that is very particular and should be obvious is that a child has an attraction towards the parent of the opposite sex during the time period of age 3 to 6. All that mama and papa have to do is embrace each other for a little longer period of time, and the little kid comes, powie, right in the middle of them. No. Happened with both of my kids. And I've seen it happen continually. A family will walk down the street with a kid about this age, and the kid's on the outside holding hands with one of them, and the parents start holding hands, the kid's got to get right in the middle. Got to change places. A natural involvement, wanting attention, and a hostility toward the parent of the same sex, and a fear of the parent of the same sex for having a hostility toward them, and for wanting to have the total attention of the parent of the opposite sex. That is normal development. If that is not resolved during the period of time from 3 to 6, if it's not resolved, a person gets stuck in it. And I think from the four patterns of 6 marriages that we've been looking at in the last weeks or couple of weeks, you can see where the stuckness comes out. You've got immature people relating to each other. Yeah, Mark. Okay. I'll tell you about that in a second. The second type of neurotic love, and I'll get to it in your answer to it, in this, is a love which is solely based upon sexual debasement of the person who is loved. In the culture of anti-sexual families, a boy cannot believe that his mother would willingly engage in any such filthy activity as sex. Notice, this is an anti-sexual family. And therefore, he must split his mother in two. He's got to have a bad mother and a good mother. And in this love based on a sexual debasement of the object, the good woman is the virginal mother forced into sex by a sadistic father. And the bad woman is a tramp who is completely different from the mother. If this is a neurotic pattern of love that you see with somebody coming for pastoral care with you, you can dead count on it being a triangular relationship somewhere. And you can count on a sexual dysfunction as well with the wife. Yeah. I'm going to describe it in a second. In other words, one woman is for love and another woman is for sex. You have a triangle. You got two women in the triangle. Two literal women. Two literal women. Different ones. You have the husband here, and you have the wife here who has to be frigid. And you've got the mistress over here who is the bad mother. She's the tramp. Image. She's for sex. No. When you're going to see it, it's going to be with another woman involved. The kid starts this early in his growth and development. Because in an anti-sexual family, in other words, with parents who don't have their sexuality straight in their own marital relationship, are going to produce children with neurotic ideas about love. Yes. I'm going to get to... Okay. Alrighty. Let me make a statement before I talk about that. Here we have a good woman who is virginal, and we have a bad woman who is a tramp. One is for love, and one is for sex, and never the twain shall meet. And in this type of atmosphere, the prophecy is self-fulfilling. The twain are never to meet. And this type of neurotic love, the love is based on sexual denial. And that's very direct. Unconsciously, the woman, talking about the wife here, in the marriage, is a good student of practical theology. Practical psychology, excuse me. Maybe theology too. She knows how to play the role to make sure she maintains the marriage. She finds that if she is sexually responsive, her husband objects to it. She becomes the bad woman. So, she's smart. She wants to keep the marriage. So she becomes cold and frigid, or remains cold and frigid. And therefore, love can be maintained. Quote, but at the cost of sexual frustration for both husband and wife. Incidentally, in these cases, situations, the man is likewise sexually inadequate and hides his inadequacy behind his emphasis on the virtuous woman, the good woman, the one he can be in love with, who must be frigid. Yes. No, he can really be excited over here. Now, talk about it from the male side. Female side too. You can just flip-flop and you change the roles. Where the wife, at this point, we got the husband. We'll put the husband back up here. And we'll have husband with whom one can be in love, and we'll have mistress with one has a sex relationship with. And the wife cannot be excited about the husband, because then the marriage would be obstructed, but she can have a highly excited sexual relationship with the male mistress. If it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, then never the twain shall meet, she shouldn't. When she does, what do you think is going to happen? Okay, it falls back into the inserts of a mother marriage, doesn't it? And the guy comes in, he's really worried, he wants to marry his mistress, and she doesn't want her, or something's the matter, and he's scared to death. He comes to you really to find out how he can keep his wife from being vindictive and crucify him and take all his goodies away from him. Okay. Now, the next neurotic kind I mentioned a couple of days ago. And this one is the love for a virgin. This neurotic manifestation is quite similar to the love based upon sexual debasement of the person loved. Here, there is an obsessive concern, and it is permissible to love only a virgin and no other woman. In fact, in some situations, it is even forbidden to love a woman who has been previously married in some subcultures. What's very interesting about this idea is it has a strong kinship and throwback to ancient fertility cults, such as Baal and Israel's problem with Baal worship and bringing it into their worship during the pre-exilic time, Canaan, and some other fertility cults that existed in Greek world too. Don? Well, as long as he can keep her on this pedestal, okay, there is very definitely that the relationship cools, if I can put it that way. In the people that I've worked with, I've noticed that there's been some very strong fantasy material of real sexual fantasy excitement exhibited in the daydreams and dream material with regard to capturing a virgin. Reminds me of the cartoon of BC. He goes out with his club to get his wife. I wonder if they really did that. Hostility. Yeah. Rape is not necessarily, it is a sexual act, but the motivation behind it is hostility, which is interesting. Let me quote something for you. Back in 1918, Freud wrote a paper entitled The Taboo of Virginity. He only dealt with it from one side, and this is going to be the reverse, and then I want to make a comment in response to your question. He dealt with it from the side of the woman's point of view. And it was very interesting that he went back into Hebrew culture and picked up some material from that in the fertility cults and the primitive practice of the defloration of the virgin, or the bride in some situations, by a senior man of the tribe. And this was part of Baal worship, and what would happen is the high priest of the tribe, of the little community, and one of the senior men of the tribe, and a virgin from the tribe, like our Miss America pageants and things like that, would mount into a circular type of apparatus in the center square of the city. A booth kind of affair at this high pinnacle. And the priest would usher in the senior man of the tribe and the young virgin, and the senior man of the tribe and the woman would cohabit together sexually. And then the priest would come out and he would declare his benediction upon this, and everyone standing around waiting for this to happen would go into the sex orgy activity of the fertility cults. And that was a common practice. Freud looked at this and he said, he described this as the hostility of women towards the first man who possesses her. He was picking up from his clinical involvement with women that he was doing therapy with, is that there was a hostility resident within some of the women that he was involved in psychoanalysis with towards their first heterosexual partner. However, he didn't say anything about the part of the hostility of the male, as well he could. And probably because he wasn't dealing at that point in time with a large number of males in psychoanalysis with this particular problem area. The attitudes on the part of both male and female we're talking about here have to do with an anti-sex hate culture. And this is sort of a part of the sexual debasement. For a male to rape a woman is an act of violence and hostility. And the brutality of that experience has long-reaching results. In my work in the hospital context, especially at a county hospital, we received all of the rape victims who reported the incident to the police and they were brought to the hospital. Some instances, that was quite a few in any one night's time. Brutalized people. Having been brutalized already coming into a hospital context, which was depersonal, impersonal, someplace dehumanizing. The questioning process that usually went on from physician, nurse, police, sheriff, and anybody else coming around. We endeavored to implement a program which our administration wouldn't let us do. But I think it's still an excellent program. It is implemented, has been going for now about 10 years in Chicago. And that is that the chaplain on call receives what is called a code R, meaning a code rape. And he is notified in advance of the person ever arriving at the hospital, and he emergency responds to meet the person as they come in. And a clinically trained chaplain then coordinates all activities while that person is in the hospital. And that means police interviews, physician, and the works. And it's a very functional, human, rather than degrading activity going on. Oh, they might cost them some money. And they were more busy teaching doctors than they were working with people. It's amazing what we do to the indigent population of our country. Probably they get better health care than anybody in this room, by the way. But at what price do they have to pay? Laying in a bed with 15 googly-eyed type of people looking at them. Yeah. Yeah, it has a part of that. A fourth area is love as a defense against homosexuality. This is an interesting one. This is one form of Don Juanism, or its counterpart, nymphomania. Anybody not know what nymphomania is? Okay. Nymphomania is usually applied to a female who is the female counterpart to a Don Juan. She wants sex all the time. This is the best way to put it. The sexual gratification is never satisfied. Excessive sexual activity without real pleasure, maybe the best way to define this, is engaged in by a person to prove that they're not homosexual. The initial studies were presented in a case called the Schuber case in 1911, dealing with a male, first of all, and I think this can be a female counterpart as well. In the formula, I, a man, love another man. And that formula has to be negated. So one way to negate that is to say, I love a woman. On the flip side of that, I, a woman, love another woman. And to negate that, I must love a man. Now, this is a love as a defense against homosexuality, and it doesn't work. Because usually in a clinical type of thing, a number of these people exhibit homosexuality in overt manifestation sooner or later. Oh, I suppose at one point they would be. Pansexual might be a better term for it. Pan, yeah. Stimulated by anything. Oh, that's a low blow. The fifth neurotic pattern or characteristic of or type of love is homosexual love. And this really involves, first of all, and probably foremost, a denial of the opposite sex. When the partnership is examined very closely, one sees that there is a considerable amount of hatred really being manifest. And the liaisons in homosexual partnerships are notoriously brief and unstable. In the brief time that I served in pastoral ministry in San Francisco, our church was not too far from the Tenderloin District. And it amazed me when I heard certain stories from that area of the community how much partner swapping was going on. Relationships did not last for an extensive length of time. Another thing which is manifest in this, which I think is very definitely important, is that the two people engaged in such relationships are usually acting out a relationship that looks a whole lot like a mother-child relationship. And we need to stop. So Monday we'll pick up on love as a dependency and love as transference. And by the way, when I get done with that, I'm going to deal with the five stages of growing into maturity in love. Okay. When we terminated class last week, I was talking about the neurotic love pattern, which was homosexual love. And I mentioned that this actually involved a denial of the opposite sex and usually involved a hatred, and that liaisons between homosexual type love affairs were notoriously brief and unstable. And I think I concluded with the statement that the two are usually acting out a mother-child relationship, which is a dependency relationship. And next week we'll talk about that in terms of something called symbiosis, S-Y-M-B-I-O-S-I-S. The area of love as dependency the neurotic form of love, which is number 6 on the overhead that we were using last time, has to do with the dependency aspect in the love relationship. This is found more often among females than among males, though not exclusively. So we can see it in both sexes, but we'll see it predominantly with females as opposed to males. Love in this particular instance takes the form of submission and suggestion that I will do anything for you, just love me in return, is the message which is unconsciously presented. In these relationships, the increasing dependency of the lover comes more and more intolerant to the other partner. And in fact, this type of dependency is one which historically has been most closely identified with love. It is culturally the most common pattern of neurotic love. And it is more masochistic in form. And inevitably, or shall we say almost inevitably, it turns towards a masochistic type of behavior pattern. It is the search for the unattainable. And since the unattainable is looked for, you always feel lousy and self-punishing. That's where the masochistic type of behavior comes in. The search for the unattainable. Love is a dependency. Back in 1118, there was a writer which, in a book called The Art of Courtly Love, which was published, republished in 1969, defines love as a masochistic dependency in the following words, and I quote, "Love is a certain inborn suffering derived from the sight of an excessive meditation, from the sight of an excessive meditation upon the beauty of the opposite sex, which causes each one to wish above all things to embrace the other, and by common desire to carry out all love's precepts in the other's embrace." End quote. Masochistic dependency in love will be seen in depression, because if you're always looking for the unobtainable, you never find it.
therefore you feel depressed. So clinically speaking, in this type of situation, the person who is into a neurotic form of love as dependency sets themselves up to feel depressed, and they do so a great deal. The TA people sometimes call a game that fits into this of kick me, where the person who is in the masochistic position is looking to be kicked all the time in some way. I have a psychiatrist friend who used to describe a number of situations. He said, I have this woman who came in to see me. He said, I finally had to tell her last week that she came in and she was 80% depressed. He says, we are now at the point of having cured her medical depression, and now we have her at 70% depressed because of her lifestyle. And about the time she moves out of kicking herself, she'll find someone else to do it for her. Thriving on unattainableness. Needs to see herself as inadequate, not being successful. And hence sets themselves up for a marital pattern dyad in which success is not obtained.
Paranoia, in fact, a paranoid person who is confronted with reality doesn't mean that they're going to move from their paranoia. They still may maintain their paranoid, delusional system regardless of what reality is, because that's what they're doing anyway. They take reality and reinterpret it through their filter system, which is sick. And really, it is a defense mechanism. So they don't have to deal with aspects about themselves, or for that matter, have to deal about themselves in relationship to the real world around them. Now, I have a very strong suggestion in dealing particularly with the paranoid marriage group. And that is that you don't endeavor to do any extended pastoral care function with them in terms of marriage counseling, but that you refer them to somebody. Let me show you why with this particular group. In the conjugal paranoia, even the skilled clinician can get roped in by this delusional system. And it's only by means of the most careful investigation and close scrutiny will the distortions and exaggerations of accusations be disclosed. And most pastors simply do not, one, have the training or the time to be engaged in that type of intense, caring, helping type of function. If the clinician does his or her work, they should be able to discover the precipitating activities which brought about the delusional charges. You see something behind the so-called factual elements. Yes. I think that by and large you're going to see the lovesick wife, coldsick husband, and the in search of a mother marriage, and the what's the other one that we called? Blocking. The parasite marriage. These three are going to be the most prominent that you'll see in your office. However, you may see some paranoid marriages, and you may see the type of thing which is involved in conjugal paranoia, but it should be much more limited. Yeah, and the folie à deux, hope you never see them. Okay, that could happen in any
in the other ones too.
What we're talking about here is overt psychiatric symptomatology of paranoid delusions. By using those terms, obviously I'm talking about a referral as necessary. But you need to be aware that there are people that have this type of extreme marital problem. Because one of the things which you'll see is the early stages, that doesn't mean they'll develop into this, but the early kinds of subtleties that are involved in some of these four types, or even the three types of paranoid marriages. For instance, when the husband is a paranoid mate, the passive wife tends to be prone towards depression. Now, back that out of the psychiatric symptomatology and put it back into the area on the previous older head where we were talking about the marital situation where the husband actively engages in fault-finding or demoralizing or degrading or humiliating type of behavior focused on and aimed at putting down the wife. And the wife is a passive type of person. She is going to exhibit patterns of depression. The other thing that's coupled with this is that husband will tend to be overly concerned about his masculinity. And that's part of the precipitating aspects of his jealousy and his suspicion. The other aspect that we will see, you would see in the marriage dynamics themselves, is that this overly concerned about his masculinity, jealous, suspicious husband with paranoid tendencies actually denies intimacy with his wife. Doesn't want to get close to her because he's so frightened of losing his own personhood, of being engulfed. I'll exhibit. I saw a couple once, whole family, bunch of kids. Guy had a good job, successful supervisor on his job. Couldn't get along with people, but he was successful in what he did since it was mostly mechanical in his supervision. And his company had sent him to, I don't know, they tried everything to get him to be a better supervisor, short of firing him. He'd come close to that on a few occasions. This character had five boys. Stair steps. The big one was a huge step. And had some problems with the kid. Guy didn't want his wife to be on her medication for her high blood pressure. If she wasn't, she was in serious danger of dying. After all, we believe in divine healing. He also didn't want a wife to go outside of the home. He'd come home from his work, he'd go out and he'd check her vehicle to see what the odometer reading was on it. They had a separate refrigerator in the garage. And that refrigerator had his food in it. You see, he ate different food than his wife and the five boys did. He was super concerned about his appearance and about his masculinity in terms of his appearance, and overtly jealous and suspicious. And his relationship with his wife, intriguingly interesting, the guy got the shakes so bad it was almost like DTs when he and his wife were alone together. I forget, she described a scene to me once, and I almost wasn't believing my ears. She said that their king-size bed vibrated across the floor because of his gyrations.
emotionally induced, so nervous. Now, the guy was scared to death of losing his identity. In a very sick marriage. So far, he hasn't resulted in killing his wife yet. Well, he wouldn't kill her directly. Just get her not to take her high blood pressure medicine. That's all. Well, he successfully got rid of his first wife. See, the way that he did was she went out on him. And, of course, that was an offense that he could use to keep in good graces with the church. And allow him to marry this lovely young woman in another city who was abandoned by her husband. But the result was a very traumatic type of sick situation. Very sick. To the extent that the reason for counseling was when the wife totally broke down. And survive it any longer. Okay. What can we draw from what we've been saying? Are there conclusions that come out of these patterns of marriage? I think there are. When we look at them, we've looked at four major types and three subtypes of one of them. The sick marriages themselves exhibit, you know, the overt types of activities with regard to people. From the lovesick wife, cold sick husband marriage pattern, something I think that is very important to see is that the wife's inability to support herself helped involve her into a lovesick situation. She could not stand being alone. Hence, she could not stand on her own. And thus, in an unprotective type of situation, her cognitive function, her reasoning function, her thinking functions would become very overwhelmed with emotion. And she would become illogical. Irrational. And the reason for exhibiting such irrational and illogical behavior was aimed at necessitating her husband's action to assume her logical and rational function. She doesn't then have to think for herself. She can be Little Miss Scatterbrain, unorganized, so forth, because her obsessive husband comes along and he will assume her thinking process. The cold, sick husband exhibits an outstanding psychological problem. He cannot stand intimacy. And the wife's overwhelming need for intimacy presents to him a place where he reacts with withdrawal, and he withdraws further behind his own defenses. You see, the cold, sick husband can support himself, but he cannot emotionally support someone else. Thus, the cold, sick husband can be alone and separate, but he has extreme difficulties being together and intimate with another person. Conclusion: the marriage does not involve a constantly functioning, working relationship which is supportive for each mate, and which is protective for the children of the family. Let me say it again. The marriage of the lovesick wife, cold sick husband, does not involve a constantly functioning, working relationship which is supportive for each partner. Nor does it allow for this type of relationship which is protective of the children in the family. The second marriage pattern we looked at, the In Search of a Mother marriage pattern, remember, had the passive husband and the dominant wife in it? The husband of this In Search of a Mother marriage pattern is one who is incapable of being self-supportive. The husband here is incapable of being separate, and thus is incapable of maintaining cognitive, rational, reasonable function without someone to hold his hand to help him think. This is the guy that I talk about having his umbilical cord plugged in again. You see, when this In Search of a Mother husband doesn't get the support that he wants on demand, he decompensates emotionally. Or he's got to go find some other woman to support him. He's got to find another mother figure. The wives and the other women who are involved in the In Search of a Mother marriage pattern are uniformly capable and adequate in their own right, meaning that they are able to take care of themselves. And they are able to take care of other people to some degree. That is, if you want to be nominated. To the extent that these women's capacities are not undermined by the need for them to care for dependent, clinging people, we would have to conclude that they're healthy. In other words, if they don't have their electromagnetic fields turned on to collect dependent, clinging type of people around them, if that's not going on, you probably would assume that they would be healthy, emotionally healthy. But the more these women are enslaved and driven by their needs to take care of dependent and clinging people, the more they will deviate from an emotionally healthy behavior pattern. You see, the need to have a dependent, clinging person attached to them is apparently some type of activity, emotional activity, which they find it very difficult to master. The third marriage pattern we looked at was the double parasite marriage. With the double parasite marriage pattern, we saw that it involved the inability of both marital partners to support themselves and each other. What this means then is that the marriage relationship has no supportive structure to it, which makes for a compatible or stable marriage. You need a supportive structure within a marriage relationship to establish a stable marriage. A double parasite marriage does not have that. Of the paranoid types of marriages, well, let me back up. The double parasite marriage, remember, that's the one where they got one chair, and the person who sits in that chair is the one who gets taken care of, and they're both trying to sit in it. And it's not big enough for both of them to sit there at the same time. The type of the paranoid marriage system that we call the folie à deux, madness in two, illustrates a relationship with no structure separating it, and yet at the same time uniting. Yeah. The folie à deux, or madness in two, pathological, paranoid type of marriage, illustrates a relationship with no structure separating and yet uniting the two partners. They sort of merge together in their craziness as if they were one, and yet they don't add up to one. You can't draw a line between one or the other because you're not sure which is which. You see, what is involved in this folie à deux type of marriage is that it shows a fusion with no spaces in the togetherness. A fusion with no spaces in the togetherness. How many remember the program we did back in the fall quarter on three series of chapel services on marriage? Remember the one that I did on the marriage ceremony itself? Do you remember in the ceremony itself I made a statement such as, let there be spaces in your togetherness, or let there be separations in your togetherness? It's most important to have a healthy functioning marriage to have a difference between the marital partners who form a unit together. They don't merge their emotional identities, so they come up with less than one between them. You see, in the folie à deux type of marriage, the fusion has no spaces in their togetherness. The dominant mate forges a bond of enslavement around the submissive mate. Oh, there's a number of different possibilities for that. Part of it is self-love in a negative sense, not the Schuller term for self-love. It's a narcissism is the clinical term for it. They love themselves like Narcissus when he looked into the water, saw himself, fell in love with himself. And it goes back to problems which relate to growth and development of about the 18 months to 3 years of age time, as far as their beginning roots, and the inability to be separate and distinct and stand on one's own two feet. That's where the roots are. Yeah. What are you leading up to? Oh, you mean our egotism? That we're right and everybody else is wrong? That has its roots back then too. With a little bit further back into the fantasy that we are the center of the universe. Eric Fromm has some very good ways of looking at the way people go about trying to do things. And I would suggest if you want to do some reading in that, his Art of Loving, for instance, would be a very good book. In fact, I don't know if it's on the syllabus, but it is possible for your collateral in here if you'd like. Eric Fromm, The Art of Loving. What conclusions can we draw then? A minimal definition of mental health in our American culture was presented a number of years ago by a group called Action for Mental Health. And it simply put is this: the ability to stand on one's own two feet without too much imposition upon others. legs. Pretty good. The ability to stand on one's own 2 feet without too much imposition upon others. That's the minimal definition of mental health. A marriage creates the need to be capable of supporting others. So, in marriage, one not only has to stand on their own 2 feet, but they also need to develop the capacity to be supportive to their marital partner, as well as to children from that union. There needs to be a mutual supportiveness. This mutual supportiveness creates the unifying framework which neither individual can form by themselves. You can't have a marriage with one person in it. So a healthy marriage is a union between two people who are self-supporting and supportive of others, and who are committed to their marriage union. Notice, this simple definition of a healthy marriage fails to be exhibited in the patterns of the sick marriages we've looked at. Some of them came close to this by having at least a self-supporting member. But that self-supporting member couldn't stand the intimacy or the supporting of others. So, again, a healthy marriage is a union between two individuals who are self-supporting and supportive of others and who are committed to their marriage union. When Scripture says, "For this reason, a man shall leave his mother and father and join himself to a woman and become husband and wife," the assumption in that action is that the person is self-supportive and hence can leave mother and father. And that in the new marriage situation, in particular when Scripture says, "Husbands, love your wives." The word love is agapao, a derivative of that verb form, of a self-sacrificial love without expectation of returns and not carried out with regard to whether the other person merits the love, is beautiful, or as ugly as they come. Has no regard to the emotional aspect or their past lifestyle or whether their nose is turned upside down and one of their ears flaps when they walk. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands. An activity of self-regulation. That, because it's in the middle voice there in Scripture, cannot be commanded by the husband. Notice the commanding that we saw in the sick marriages. In the paranoid marriages in particular, if the wife didn't go along with the delusions, she became the object of the delusional system in some of them. Accused of everything under the sun. If there was an eclipse, she had to cause it. To be submissive or to subordinate oneself has to do with a voluntary action on the part of the female. And I, for one, feel that it has something also to do with the simple biology of being a male and being a female. and the psychological makeup that is involved in that. The conclusion, then, that a healthy marriage is a union between two individuals who are self-supportive and supportive of others and who are committed to their marriage union, this conclusion is in keeping with the insights which can be derived from both pathological marriage as well as in keeping with the psychoanalytic concepts of psychosocial development from our earliest symbiotic mother-child relationship through separation and individualization on to maturity, wisdom, knowledge, and the capacity to feel kinship with another person and to feel love for another human being as well as for oneself. Yeah. Right, that's my next point. Ideally, in marriage, independence is equal, dependence is mutual, and obligation is reciprocal. Obviously, there are going to be a number of variations on this. The aspect of independence being equal is it takes two peers to make a marriage. Two individually separated individuals, people, meaning who have separated from their parents and are self-sufficient, often emotionally self-sufficient. Obviously, in our day and age, to be financially self-sufficient is another issue altogether. And I'm not too sure when that ever is reached, if ever. So that the equality between these two individuals who are independent is a prerequisite for the ideal of the marriage. Galatians, Paul's writing in Galatians, states that the male and the female are equal in God's sight, meaning equal of worth. Dependence must be mutual. By that, I mean the supportive aspects that we've been referring to. The independence is the self-supportive aspect. The dependence is the supportive of others aspect. What happens in a marital situation if there's one person in the marriage who's supposed to never get sick, and that person is the wife? What happens if she gets sick? Husband gets irritable, yells at the kids, wants to get out of the house, as frustrated as he can be. The kids get whiny, behavior pattern degenerates, potty training accidents occur. Kid runs away. All different kinds of things happen. If the marriage situation is set up where one person can never be dependent upon anybody else for supportive activities rendered to them. You see, marriage is a caring, loving, supportive activity. If marriage were only a relationship of dependency, then somebody would have to figure out who's going to sit in the dependent chair at what time and get taken care of. Obligation is reciprocal. Marriage is a committed union. It is a covenant between two people. A contractual agreement. The problem many times is that our contracts also are unwritten contracts with unconscious motivators. So one would say that there are many variations from the ideal, which I've listed here, that may even still allow for a marriage to be considered normal and functional. My wife surprised the living daylights out of me a week ago. She's done some things that I've been surprised about, such as when she changed the plumbing underneath the kitchen sink when I was on call at the hospital one night, and things such as that. By the way, I changed plumbing too. It's a mutual thing around the house, I've come to find out. Anyway, last week, she decided that when she looked at my schedule for the week, that there was no way that I was going to be able to mow the lawn, and it needed to be mowed. And I haven't had a chance to repair the lawnmower since I moved from Texas, because I haven't been used since then. And needed a new spark plug, some oil put in. So she took the spark plug out of the lawnmower. She went down to the auto store down the road over at Peace and showed them the spark plug, and they gave her a new one. She paid for a new one. She brought it back, set it up like she'd seen other people do, and screwed it back in the lawnmower, unscrewed a little valve to see if there was any oil in it, put some more oil in it, started the thing up, mowed half the yard. Well, the funny part about it was just before she was getting ready to go down to the bottle store to get the spark plug, is a kid came along and knocked at the front door and offered to mow the lawn for a fee, of course. And there she was standing with the spark plug in her hand. He was quite dumbfounded to see her or hear what she had to say to him, that no, she was going to do it herself. Well, if I had asked her to do that, first of all, I don't think I would have the nerve to do that. Second, I wouldn't expect her to do that. You see, in our mutual dependent system and our independence with each other, our separateness and our togetherness, there is leeway. You see, sometimes we get so stereotyped into our super male image or super female image that we fail to see that things don't make us male or female. We make ourselves male or female. Talking about maleness and femaleness. Marriage is not a static state. Boy, that's an understatement. It is simply one phase or multiple phase of an individual's growing lifestyle, life cycle. It is one phase or series of phases in the lifestyle where each person in the marriage may experience growth and develop. Further growth, further development. And it will occur through the intimate experience with a partner. You see, marriage is a state in which the partners can help one another to reach the full status of being responsible, autonomous, separate individuals. Though their adolescent strivings need to be well in hand before engaging and establishing an intimate marital type of relationship, be that as it may, marriage is still a state in which the partners can help each other to reach the full status of being responsible, autonomous, dads without umbilical cords plugged in and separate individuals. If this does not occur, the marriage will become static, and it will become a state in which the partners experience intensity and intimacy, which causes them serious emotional problems, even to the extent of regressing to childhood, childish types of behavior patterns and ways of relating, and behavior which can be seen as psychopathological. Thus, we must conclude that marriage has the capacity for growth or destructiveness. And both of these are capable there. One other further comment. A normal marriage involves a relationship between two equally self-supporting and supportive adults. Obviously, 100% support cannot occur. It's got to be a give and take. A second conclusion that needs to be stated is that no person remains the same in each stage of your life cycle. You change. And we'll pick up there next time, finish this section, and on Wednesday we'll get into the meaning of love and human experience. And I'll give you 7 neurotic characteristics of pathological sick love. And then we'll find out what mature spiritual type of love is, what's needed in a marriage. See you.
At the close of last class period, I was talking about a marital situation in which we were talking in terms of the conclusions that we can draw about healthy marriages based upon a study of sick marriages and some needs that are involved in this. I think we finished on the aspect of an ideal. Ideally, in a marriage, there is independence, which is equal, dependence, which is mutual, and obligation, which is reciprocal. Yet, we need to be aware that there are many variations from this as an ideal that still may allow us to call a marriage healthy or normal. Part of this is involved with the fact that a marriage is not a static state. In other words, it is one phase of an individual's entire life cycle, or a combination of phases in that person's life cycle. And it is a phase in particular where further growth and development can and must occur. And this development has as its source of impetus and fertilization the intimate experience with a marital partner or one's mate. Thus, we can conclude that marriage is a state in which the partners can help one another to reach a full status of being responsible, of being autonomous, and of being separate individuals. If this does not occur, in other words, if the marriage partners do not work together for increasing each's responsibility and autonomy and separateness in their togetherness, if that doesn't occur, the marriage will become a state in which the partners experience intensity and intimacy which cause serious problems to them. And the clinical term that's involved is regression, meaning that their behavior with each other will tend to revert back to more primitive kinds of behavior as children relating to parents or peers. And I present this to you as a fact. If the marriage does not grow, it will become childish in its dynamics and sick. Mark, are you getting ready to ask a question? Okay. Marriage is a state in which the partners can help one another to reach a full status of being responsible, of being autonomous, and of being separate individuals. That's simply a definition of adulthood. It comes right down to it. It has something to do with being mature. A responsible individual, an autonomous individual, a separate individual is a description of a person who is able to stand on their own two feet. Doesn't have to have their umbilical cord plugged into somebody all the time. Marriage then has the capacity for growth and or destructiveness. Every marriage. The normal marriage then must consist of a relationship between two equally self-supporting and supportive adults. Now, obviously, there's never going to be 100% support. Yet there must be a self-supporting involvement, which is the majority, if not two-thirds, of the relationship that a person has. Remember the diagram I drew up here of the four-prong type of relationships with the assumption bond and the contingency bond and the trust bond and the trust in the relationship bonding? Remember that diagram back at the beginning of the quarter? Or was that in this course? I've drawn it so many times I forget which course I drew it. I didn't draw it. Okay, I'll get to it later. Last quarter? Last quarter. Okay, makes sense. No person remains the same in each stage of his or her life cycle. And that's a principle that you can count on. Yeah. No person remains the same in each stage of his or her life cycle.